It's Thursday, April 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, we speak with the VOA journalists involved in researching the Panama Papers that detail offshore financial accounts.
You're opening, let's say, a file that has got more than 20,000, files on one individual, and you need to go that single by single of the files to make sure that you get the information, you understand what is going on.
Tensions emerge between Turkey's president and prime minister, and country music fans mourn the death of singer Merle Haggard. It's all ahead. The Panama Papers consist of more than 11.5 million documents leaked from the Panamanian law firm Mossack Fonseca that detail hidden offshore accounts held by world leaders and celebrities. The International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, ICIJ, in a collaborative effort by more than 300 journalists from more than 70 countries, analyzed the financial data. The ICIJ report contains details on more than 214,000 offshore entities connected to people in more than 200 countries and territories. Ray Chodo, senior editor of VOA's Zimbabwe service, is among the journalists who worked on the project. I spoke with him about his involvement.
I started digging the data maybe a couple of months ago. And again, you may have access to the data, but that's not a story on its own. Yeah, you need to understand the data, the trend of the information and the paper trail that is in there. You are opening, let's say, a file that has got more than 20,000, files on one individual. And you need to go that single by single of the files to make sure that you get the information, you understand what is going on, and to then sit back and think about the information, whether there is something that is worth following. So some of the stuff, really, it has been stuff that has been out in the media. Some of it, you could tell it was just a simple business transaction and you just leave it as it is. But where you raise the question, that's when you need to sort of find the answers as to why are you raising that question. Is there some break of the law involved, some violation of some laws and everything? So that took quite some time, really.
Now, this involves, there's a list of people involved in this. There are also a list of leaders of countries, either they or members of their families or close associates. I'm thinking Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron, Russian President Vladimir Putin. There are others. There is also an in-law relative by marriage of Chinese President Xi Jinping is named, a number of them. When your team was beginning this, did you have an idea that some of these world leaders would have links to this whole situation with this firm in Panama?
No, to begin with, I had no idea. As for myself, I did not have an idea. It was just the data that I had to look through and look at anything that has to do with Zimbabwe. You raised the issue of leaders. Yes, we came across some people named or closely linked to ZANU-PF or to the president of Zimbabwe, President Robert Mugabe. This is how kind of his business associates, people who have been funding the party for a long period of time, which is not new information as far as Zimbabweans are concerned. So I was mainly interested in finding something that is very new. You talk about Prime Minister David Cameron, you talk about President Vladimir Putin of Russia. Those were not our area, I guess, as Zimbabwean, because we had other journalists who were working on those. And one thing that we agreed in common was that there was no one who was going to scoop anyone. We're going to work as a team, collaborate. Where you find information which could be helpful to a friend, you can always give a heads up and say, oh, there is this on Mugabe. Do you think you might be interested? I have received those things and I looked at the information. I looked at it. There was nothing new. It has been in the media. We've covered it before. Mm-hmm. But somebody in Germany might find it very interesting. So I was looking for information that is new, that is something that has to do with Zimbabwe, wherever it is, be it in Britain, be it wherever, but as long as it has a Zimbabwean connection, because that was the primary responsibility that I had on the project, was to tackle Zimbabwean issues.
So, but Mugabe himself is not named in this?
Mugabe is named in the correspondence.
So his associates?
His associates, yes. But right. There is no way And I'm not really going to really dig too much into it that we can say this is what Mugabe is doing, but his associates are named in the correspondence, and there is information because they're dealing with individuals. We had to go through vetting and everything. I would give you an example of John Bredenkamp, where Mossack Fonseca, raised an issue that, no, this guy is under UN sanctions, he's under the EU sanctions, he's under the U.S. sanctions, and they go through him, and then through those documents, they find that he is on the sanctions list because of his association with President Robert Mugabe. Is that a new story to Zimbabweans? To some, maybe, but the majority of Zimbabwe are aware about that. But what is new is the things that we'll be looking at. Are there any new development? Because we've covered those stories. John Bredenkamp's involvement in supporting ZANU-PF and Mugabe's party, that's not something new. We have covered about it, and it's on record. But what we are looking at is some new information that would give us some new insights into the operations of John Bredenkamp or President Robert Mugabe.
Will the investigations continue?
The investigations are continuing, and we still have more stories that are going to come, especially on our part, on the Zimbabwe side. We still have more Zimbabwean stories with the Zimbabwean angle that are going to come out of the investigations.
That's Ray Choto, senior editor of VOA Zimbabwe Service and among the ICIJ who worked on the Panama Papers. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media and editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, the next big nominating contest in the race for president is New York. And so all the candidates are heading up there trying to get the votes, get out and inspire people to vote for them. And we're seeing on social media some moments that are trending for maybe not the best reasons, I guess you could say. Hillary Clinton riding the New York City subway had some trouble getting through the turnstile, had to swipe her Metro card several times. So she's getting a little bit of ridicule for that. Bernie Sanders, however, said that people still use tokens to ride the subway, which I think they stopped using in the late 1990s. So people laughing a bit about that. And then Ted Cruz had some protesters in the Bronx, people saying he shouldn't be in the Bronx, the borough of New York City. So he's facing some protests there. Donald Trump facing protests in a rally in Long Island, a lot of photos and videos of that, and some clashes there. I think they said there had to be some arrests made at the protest, and some elderly people fainted and carried out on stretchers. So kind of a wild scene in Bethpage, New York, on Long Island, where he's holding a rally there. But all eyes on New York, and of course, New York is the Big Apple. There's going to be a lot of social media attention that we're going to see in the next couple of weeks until that nominating contest.
And several of these candidates have connections to New York, too.
Exactly. Hillary Clinton was the senator from New York. Bernie Sanders was born in Brooklyn. Donald Trump was born in the borough of Queens. So there's a lot of New York connection for sure. Other big story today, Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, announcing that he wants within 5 years, Facebook to be mostly video. Now, this is part of his big push with Facebook Live. And incidentally, we're doing a Facebook Live broadcast right now. So you can go online to our Facebook page, VOA Now, and you can watch it there. But he did actually a Facebook Live yesterday to announce this. The problem was that it kind of cut out for some people, and it didn't turn out very well in terms of some technical issues. But he's making this big video push. We are as well here with Facebook Live. We'll hope you'll watch us online, and we'll see how this develops.
Absolutely. Thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
California scientists have found that people who frequently check their Facebook pages may not be doing so because they enjoy the interactivity of social media, but because they may not be getting enough sleep. After analyzing data collected from 76 undergraduate students, researchers from the University of California, Irvine, say that they found a direct link between chronic lack of sleep, a bad mood, and an increased dependence on checking out Facebook pages. The study also showed a link between sleep deprivation and being distracted. According to the study's lead researcher, Gloria Mark, if someone is distracted, they often go online and check their Facebook page because it's easy and they're tired. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has called sleep deprivation a public health epidemic. Lack of sleep has been linked to potentially life-threatening incidents like car and industrial accidents. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, efforts continue to stop the global use of tobacco. Growing growing political differences are emerging again between Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu as the country faces increasing domestic and international woes. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
The Turkish military crackdown on the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK, has become the focal point of growing differences between the president and prime minister. Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu opened the door to a resumption of peace talks with the PKK if it withdrew its forces from Turkey. That drew a swift rebuke from President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who ruled out talks, saying the rebels either had to surrender or be killed. When the Prime Minister voiced concern over the controversial pre-trial detention of academics who organised a petition for a resumption of peace talks with the PKK, Erdogan again contradicted Davutoğlu. "Why shouldn't academics be detained?" Erdogan asked, openly challenging the Prime Minister. "Turkey should consider stripping supporters of terrorism of their citizenship." Carnegie Institute visiting scholar Sinan Ülgen says the divisions expose a deepening power struggle.
In Turkey, constitutionally, the prime minister has executive authority, but we are now witnessing a governance where the president himself has taken the initiative to speak on almost all executive matters. So it's unavoidable that we see, and we shall continue to see, these type of differences of opinion emerging. But so far, Erdogan continues to dominate the political agenda.
Erdogan retains an iron grip on the ruling AKP and the loyalty of many ministers in Davutoğlu's government. When Erdogan was pushing for the stripping of citizenship of terrorist sympathisers, Davutoğlu said it was not on the agenda. Davutoğlu was then contradicted by the Justice Minister, Bekir Bozdağ, who declared steps are being taken. Political columnist Semi Idiz of Turkey's Cumhuriyet newspaper and Al Monitor website says despite Davutoğlu's weak party position and isolation in government, it's still not easy for Erdogan to remove him.
The AKP and the country now is like a big ship in the middle of a storm. I mean, do you want a fight in the captain's cabin when we're dealing with so many issues, domestic and external, which might end up landing everybody in a much worse position than before? And I think this is another thing that he has to factor in.
Erdogan, the first president elected by the people, is pushing for constitutional reform to extend his presidential powers. But observers say Davutoğlu is not enthusiastic. Davutoğlu recently described a presidential system strictly controlled by a strong checks and balances mechanism. While Erdogan chose Davutoğlu as the leader of the AK party, Idiz says since the November election victory, he has become very much his own man.
He may have been implanted there by Erdogan initially, and he may have lost the first elections, but he did win the second, and not only did he win it, but he brought home a landslide. So at one point or another, I think he is going to try and rely on this fact. Davutoğlu does represent a more moderate and perhaps slightly liberal line. I noticed from my contacts with diplomats in Ankara that they point to this.
Western diplomats increasingly talk of Davutoğlu as a voice of moderation, which observers say is only likely to infuriate Erdogan further. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
The number of adult cigarette smokers worldwide is increasing, particularly in poor countries, despite the adoption of a global treaty on tobacco control. However, one of the framers of that tobacco convention says reductions in smoking and deaths caused by tobacco use are achievable. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
An estimated 740 million adults worldwide use tobacco daily. Since 1980, there's been a 41% rise in the number of men who smoke regularly and a 7% increase among women. In 2005, the World Health Organization adopted the Framework on Tobacco Control, an international treaty calling on countries to take measures to discourage tobacco use. Some 180 countries are signatories, and where there's strong anti-smoking laws, evidence shows tobacco use goes down, according to Laurent Hubert, the executive director of Action on Smoking and Health. Hubert led non-governmental organizations in helping to put together the framework. France is an example of the impact of anti-tobacco measures. Uber points to the country's adoption of a stiff tax on cigarettes. He says the tax slashed cigarette smoking nearly in half, but it went up again by 7% between 2014 and 2015, when the country failed to adjust the tax to keep pace with inflation.
But it's not, as some people sometimes ask, is this about banning or making the product illegal? And that's not what it's about. It's about regulating the product so we can avoid the large public health impact it has and decrease prevalence of smoking to very low levels.
Tobacco kills 6 million people a year, says Uber, and 1 billion people are projected to die by the end of the century. The Tobacco Convention has set a goal of reducing cigarette smoking by 30% from 2010 levels by the year 2025. Other anti-smoking actions that have met with success include banning cigarette use in public places and graphic images printed on cigarette packs. Uber says the pictures showing the health effects of cigarette smoking are most effective in impoverished areas.
They're better understood and they have more impact. And in jurisdictions where you have also an illiterate population, then obviously they also make it much more effective to understand what the message is about. So they are effective.
80% of countries require cigarette packs to display graphic images. But in some countries, like India, factions influenced by big tobacco companies are fighting back, and it's hard to get anti-smoking measures enacted. Uber is optimistic that the target to reduce cigarette smoking worldwide will be met. Currently, there are no sanctions to enforce the goal of the International Tobacco Treaty, but Uber says that's the next step, to encourage compliance with the global campaign to end smoking. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Country music great Merle Haggard has died. He passed away at his home in California on Wednesday. VOA's David Byrd spoke with Jay Orr of the Country Music Hall of Fame in Nashville, Tennessee, about the life and legacy of Merle Haggard.
One of the legends of country music, one of the pillars of country music, Merle Haggard passed away, ironically, on his 79th birthday. Merle is one of those people that people point to as, if I could be like him, I would be satisfied with my career. What was his contribution, and what do you think his legacy will be?
Merle was one of the greats of country music. It's hard to sum up his achievement in the field, but he was a songwriter. He was a performer. He was a musician. He stood shoulder to shoulder with the people we think of as the greats of the genre, people like Hank Williams, Willie Nelson, Kris Kristofferson, and Johnny Cash. But he really embodied the country music singer-songwriter. In the museum here, the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum, we have what we call our core exhibit that tells the story of country music. And we've called the core exhibit Sing Me Back Home, A Journey Through Country Music. Of course, Sing Me Back Home is a Merle Haggard song. He connects with the story that we tell in a great and important way.
Now, he was a very versatile songwriter. He could write about songs about broken hearts, like I think about Silver Wings or Today I Started Loving You Again. He also did some stuff that was autobiographical, things like Mama Tried or Hungry Eyes, because he grew up literally in a railroad car turned into a house in California. And he used that. He used his own life experience to write these songs that are just as poignant today as they were when he first penned them.
Well, you said it yourself, David. That's really true. He drew from his own experience, and he drew from the experience of working men and women in America. I think of a song like Working Man Blues, which is a phrase that people use to describe country music. Working man's blues or blue-collar blues. He really was in touch, much like Woody Guthrie, another, Merle's roots were in Oklahoma, although he grew up in California. Woody Guthrie the same way, and in the same way that Woody Guthrie sang about people of the soil, Merle did as well. And we invited Merle to be our artist in residence. He said, "What do I have to do?" And I said, "Well, one thing is you should not do the same thing on two consecutive nights." He said, "I never do the same thing on two consecutive nights."
And I'm proud to be an Okie from Muskogee, a place where even squares can have a ball.
The music of the late Merle Haggard, and earlier we heard from Jay Orr of the Country Music Hall of Fame in Nashville. That's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Speaking at the conclusion of the recent nuclear security summit in Washington, President Barack Obama pointed to the nuclear deal agreed to by Iran, the European Union, and the P5+1 countries, the JCPOA, as one of the top accomplishments in his administration's drive to halt the spread of nuclear weapons. Regarding the JCPOA, Mr. Obama said his first priority had been to make sure that Iran's nuclear weapons program was stopped and that material that would have given Iran a very short breakout capacity was shipped out of the country. That has happened, he said. President Obama noted that so far, Iran's leaders have lived up to the JCPOA to the letter.
They have, in fact, based on the presentations that were made by the IAEA this morning to the P5+1, followed the implementation steps that were laid out. And as a consequence, sanctions related to their nuclear program have been brought down.
Mr. Obama said that Iran does face a challenge in getting businesses to feel comfortable that the JCPOA is holding and that there are no longer risks due to nuclear sanctions if companies do business with Iran. President Obama pledged to address some of the concerns Iran has expressed over this issue. But President Obama cautioned that the spirit of the JCPOA involves Iran also sending signals to the world community and businesses that it is not going to be engaging in a range of provocative actions that might scare business off.
When they launch ballistic missiles with slogans calling for the destruction of Israel, that makes businesses nervous. If Iran continues to ship missiles to Hezbollah, that gets businesses nervous.
President Obama said that the United States has a responsibility to provide clarity about the rules that govern so that the Iranian people can benefit from an improved economic situation. But, Mr. Obama stressed, Iran has to understand what every country in the world understands, which is businesses want to go where they feel safe, where they don't see massive controversy, where they can be confident that transactions are going to operate normally.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.